perhaps the only one which we find in funeral and also in wedding services. And not only the most popular, but also, I think, one of the most personal. Many years ago, I heard this story. An army chaplain in World War I was preaching on this text to a number of men on the night before an attack. And at the close of his service, he held up his left hand and pointing to each finger in turn, he said, "The Lord is my shepherd." Now he said, if any of you tonight want to make Jesus Christ your Lord, your Savior, your shepherd, push down that fourth finger with your thumb and close your fist. And that will be a sign to yourself and to him that you have committed yourself to him. The battle took place the next day, and this padre, moving among the dead and wounded, saw in a shell hole the crumpled body of a young soldier. Turning him over very gently, he saw that the fourth finger of his left hand was pressed down by the thumb. And his grief and sorrow was just to some extent tinged with joy as he realized that the night before that young man had trusted the Savior. And the rest of this psalm will only really make sense if we can truthfully say, "The Lord is my shepherd." But if we can say that, then it makes tremendous sense and becomes one of the most precious parts of the Bible. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside quiet waters. He restores my soul. It's been said that David is depicting a day in the life of the sheep in this psalm, and it begins in the peaceful pastures and meadowlands. Being retired and perhaps to some extent living alone means that I have the advantage of starting each day with a time by those still waters, praying, pondering, reading the Bible and other Christian books. How the busy housewife with children to get off to school, or the businessman catching that early train to London, how they cope, I just don't know. Perhaps they can make use of Sunday. But one way or another, it's terribly important that each of us for himself finds that personal oasis where we can be alone, apart, and away with the Lord, day by day, week by week. It's in that way that he's able to restore our soul, to recharge those spiritual and moral batteries which can so quickly and easily get run down. Find an oasis in this busy, hurried, noisy world where you can be alone with God. He guides me in paths of righteousness for his name's sake. We can't spend all our time by still waters and in quiet pastures. We must move on. As soon as we get up each day, we are faced with a labyrinth of decisions and choices, of turnings and junctions and crossroads. Most of these we can take in our stride. John Wesley used to say that the principle on which he based his whole life was the scriptures and common sense. A Christian is someone who has developed what might be called sanctified common sense. And this will help him to make probably 80-90% of his decisions wisely and well. But now and then, there are vitally important ones to be made. Ones that affect not only ourselves, but other people as well. And it's very, very important that we get them right. But the God who restores our soul is able to lead us in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. How does he do it? In many ways, I think it's rather like traveling by car. To find the right way, we consult the map. We look at a compass if we happen to have one in the car. We watch the signposts and we ask the advice of people in the neighborhood. For the Christian, the Bible is his map. His conscience is the compass. The signposts are the circumstances, the qualifications, the aptitudes which condition his life. And the local people are those close friends in whom he has complete confidence. Do you remember on his second missionary journey, Paul came to a sort of cul-de-sac. The road north into Bithynia was closed, nor was he allowed to go south into Asia. And then there came that call to Macedonia. And putting all these different things together, we read in the quaint words of the King James Version, which I always rather like, assuredly gathering that God was calling him across the water into Greece. Assuredly gathering. Putting together all those different signs that God gives us and acting, not in a cocksure manner, but with quiet confidence that we've chosen the right path. But now and then that path will dip away from the sunlit uplands. But even though I walk through a valley as dark as death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. I noticed for the first time the other day when I was studying this psalm that the third person gives place to the second person. It's no longer he leadeth, but you. And I wonder, does this suggest a growing intimacy and confidence as the day progressed? Be that as it may, we've probably all spent some time in one of these valleys. Bereavement, sickness, disappointment in business or in love, redundancy, unemployment. But the God who restores and guides is a God who can also comfort. And he does so with his rod and his staff. The pastoral staff, of course, was used to restrain and, if necessary, to rescue the sheep. The rod, on the other hand, was a kind of cudgel which was used to beat off wild beasts and perhaps bandits. So we must fear no evil, believing that even in the valleys, God has a purpose for us. And as another psalmist puts it, going through the veil of misery, use it for a well. That is what Joseph was able to do. Do you remember? When he met his brothers towards the end of his life, he was able to say, "You meant it for evil, selling me into slavery, but God intended it for good, for he knew that all things work together for good to those who love God." Emerging from the valley, we find ourselves back in the desert, but this time with no pasture, no oasis, no quiet rivers in sight. And with the disgruntled Israelites of old, we might have said, "Can God provide a table here in the wilderness?" "Yes," says David, "he can." The shepherd finds a raised platform of rock on which he spreads the food and the medical supplies that he's brought. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil, and my cup overflows. We probably all know those dry, barren wilderness experiences. We're a long way from home. There seems to be no very lively church to go to. We're living in a hostile office, a cynical common room, an unfriendly mess. And like Elijah at Horeb, we become depressed and full of self-pity. Do you remember how graciously God dealt with Elijah? He provided the food using the ravens for that purpose, but at the same time he more or less said to Elijah, look, pull yourself together. Elijah thought he was the only God-fearing man in the land, but God told him that there were thousands who shared his faith. And whatever our circumstances may be, there's nearly always somewhere to be found a Christian family, a house group, another individual Christian to whom we can attach ourselves. I remember very vividly how lonely I felt as a Christian for the first time at school. And then one day I found another boy in my house who shared my faith, and we're still in touch 70 years later. But you may ask, what about those who for Christ's sake are in prison, whose freedom is curtailed? Can God furnish a table for them? Who am I to say? Let one speak for many. In 1688, Madame Guyon was condemned to 10 years in prison, wrongly accused of heresy. And this is what she wrote. My cage confines me round, abroad I cannot fly, but though my wing is closely bound, my heart's at liberty. My prison walls cannot control the flight, the freedom of the soul. So we come to the end of the day, and surely goodness and mercy will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. Notice how for a moment David seems to abandon the metaphor of the sheep and speaks of the house of the Lord. Whoever heard of sheep living in a house? But it's deliberate, for he wants to stress the idea of security and permanence. In contrast to the nomadic, tented life of the Eastern Shepherd. And of course it's a thought that Jesus takes up. On my Father's estate are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for you, a final home for the members of my family and the sheep of my flock. And do you notice how leading has given way to following? The Eastern Shepherd always led his flock. But I like to think of goodness and mercy as the names of two sheepdogs padding along behind the flock, guarding, restraining, and encouraging the sheep. So we come back to the beginning. The Lord is my shepherd. I can still remember that day, all those years ago, when I was able to say that for the first time. And no doubt, many of you in this church this evening could put a ring round a day, or at least a period of time, when it became true in your own experience. But could it be that tonight in this church there are still some who have never committed themselves to Christ, who cannot quite say, the Lord is my shepherd? Well, why not tonight? The Lord is my shepherd. To press that fourth finger with the thumb. It will be a sign to yourself that you've taken that vital, eternal step and made Jesus Christ your savior, your shepherd, and your friend. If you're seriously thinking of taking that step and think it would help, do have a word with me afterwards, and I'd like to give you a booklet which might help you to understand it a little bit more clearly and to see just what is involved for being able to say, "The Lord is my shepherd."